Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, and we have gathered a trio of scientific experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call, 800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also connect via social media. You can tweet us, if you wish, at WAMC Vox Pop. You can go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio, and we have a Vox Pop post there. You can go to our website, WAMC.org/Vox Pop. You can email us, if you wish, at WAMC. VoxPop@WAMC.org. And calling is wonderful on a call-in show. We like that. 800-348-2551 is the number. And it's the Science Forum. Let's have our scientists sign in, please, from my left.
Ed Stander, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and comic relief as necessary.
All right, sir.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist from GE Global Research in Niskayuna.
All right.
And I'm Michael Murphy. I'm a biologist and ethicist from SUNY Cobleskill.
And it's been a while since you've been on this program.
Yes, Michael. It has been a while.
Nice to have you all back here on the show. And Ed, you said you had some homework to kick off things.
I always have homework.
All right.
It comes with not knowing anything.
Well, you've done some research on one of the questions from a show. I don't even remember this question.
This is a horrible question.
Or you'll have to set it up.
Okay. The question was, why is it on the equinoxes the sun rise in the east and set in the west? That was the question.
I'll bite.
And so it's a great one if you're watching television or some other way, but trying to explain it geometrically with your hands on a radio doesn't work. So we gave an answer. We said that the sun doesn't rise from the east and set in the west on the solstice. On the equinox. It's a little bit off. And we had about 20 phone calls afterwards telling us that we were full of it.
Yeah.
Okay. But we weren't full of it. I did some research, and I found that while half people say that the sun rises in the east and sets exactly in the west, due east and due west on the equinox, the others say it doesn't.
Hmm.
And the reason for that is this, and it's a geometric problem. And if you would close your eyes, except if you're driving, and imagine this. Imagine that the Earth is a ball.
Okay.
And there is an axis sticking out at the North Pole.
All right.
Okay. When that points towards the sun, then the sun rises to the north, northeast, and sets to the northwest.
All right.
If the axis is pointing away from the sun, then the sun rises to the southeast and sets to the southwest.
All right.
Okay. But if the axis is exactly perpendicular to the orbit, then the sun rises from the east and sets to the west, almost due east. And the reason it's almost due east is because on that day of the year, the equinox, the sun is over the equator. And if you're standing on the equator, then the sun rises exactly due east and sets due west.
Mm.
But if you're anywhere north or south of the equator, it's going to be slightly off. And the trick is this. Everywhere in the world, there'll be a day when the sun rises due east and sets due west. But it'll be off by a day or two, depending on what your latitude is.
Makes sense.
So that's the answer. The answer is that half the people say that it's exactly due east, and other people say it's not. It's very similar to the old question of if you put a bunch of women on one side of the room and a bunch of men on the other side of the room, and the women can get halfway to the men each time, how long does it take to get there?
Oh.
And the answer is, of course, that they'll never get there, except for all intents and purposes.
So, Ed, with the interest in astronomy, is that true for all planets?
It is true for all planets. All planets who have a tilt, even if they don't have a tilt, Venus has very little tilt. On that one, it would be due east and due west at the equator, effectively. So it is true for all planets.
Uh-huh.
So that's why the equinox is slightly different, or the when it will pass due east and due west is slightly different for every planet, depending on what the line of latitude is.
So you did a lot of research just to prove you were right, and you did.
Well, actually, I proved that everybody else was wrong, which is much, much more valuable.
Much more satisfying, eh?
Yes.
The number to call is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 1-800-348-2551. We have one here. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall, just handed me. This is an email question. It comes from Joanne in Lee, Mass. Does hot water really freeze faster than cold water? And if so, why, people?
Oh, have we been, how many times have we had that question? How many times?
Well, obviously, it's new to Joanne, and my my memory is fairly poor, so you can refresh me.
Okay.
Go ahead.
If you take, I think the way it was usually stated is if you take a cup of hot water and a cup of cold water and put it in a fridge, which will freeze faster?
Okay.
Okay, and what's the answer?
Well, it should be the cold water.
It should be the cold water.
But everything's not equal.
That's right. And that's the answer.
So can you explain that a little bit more, Ed?
Jim, why don't you try first?
I think you actually know facts. I just have to speculate about this. In the process of heating up the water, among other things, you're going to change the how much air is dissolved in it. You could precipitate some of the minerals. So the water is not exactly the same in the hot water as the cold, as in the cold water, unless you're very, very careful about it.
Okay.
And the answer that I came up with after working on this, and I have put containers of hot water and cold water in the freezer just to make sure.
Yeah.
The trick is this. If you put hot water in a freezer, then the hot water produces steam. And the steam freezes relatively fast.
Mm.
The water from the steam falls into the cup, and that produces the nucleation sites for freezing to occur faster. So while
Brilliant.
The cold water will get to the freezing point faster, the hot water can nucleate faster, simply because it forms a relatively cold layer on the top, which then acts as nucleation sites.
Yeah, and another twist on this could be because the hot water is thermally expanded. If you put in equal volumes, you will, in fact, have fewer grams of the hot water.
To cool off.
And thereby, it would be easier to cool that down.
That makes sense. Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. James and Hudson, you're first on the Science Forum.
Hi, yes. This is another question about water.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and boiling water. If I have a gas stove, this is actually a logistical question. I have a gas stove. If I put a pot of water, not a kettle, on the stove to boil, and I turn the heat up all the way high so that it boils faster, or if I put it in the back burner and I turn it all the way down low, so it boils, you know, comes to boil later but uses less gas, which is using the least amount of energy?
Panel?
Are you there?
You haven't stumped the band.
Okay,
they're just thinking.
There's a couple things.
because I'm stumped too, and I just read a book about physics, and I know energy equals mass squared, but I'm not sure which is using the least energy.
Trust me, James. These great brains will have it figured out in a moment.
Yeah, well, part of it has to do with the amount of heat that's lost around the side of the kettle.
Yep.
Because if it's not getting a full contact with the bottom of it, then a certain amount of it's going to go over the side, and that as a result, you're going to be losing that heat. So it may heat faster, it may go faster, but it's not going to be as efficient as if the heat was directly on the bottom of it.
So you're saying slower.
Slower is more efficient, but longer.
Yeah, and I would agree with that.
Michael, you want to weigh in?
No, I learned something.
No, actually, that makes perfect sense to me. The follow-up question I would have is, what about these, you see on television, these advertisements for conductive heating devices where, you know, they're supposed to be very, very efficient and you can touch them almost immediately after you take the pot off. How are they different?
No, I've had one of those cheese, the things that make, you know, hot water for cheese.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, one that broke the last time I had it.
We're talking about a different thing there. Thanks, James, for the call. You're talking about, and I've seen these, they're not convection, but they're...
Conduction.
You have to have magnetic pots. Essentially, you need the right material.
Uh-huh.
Or the induction heating.
The induction heating. That's correct.
Yes, that's correct.
Very interesting. But I guess you can't do it with every bit of pottery that you have in the house.
You know, the big trick when you're heating water is that air is a really, really good insulator. And anytime you have any air between the surface that you're heating up and the thing itself, then you have a major problem. That's why, for example, I have a kettle with an immersion heater in it that only takes about 30 seconds to heat up. Mm. But even if you put it on a gas stove, it takes quite a while.
Mm.
Electric's the worst. And even worse than that is the radiant ones, the ones with the glass surface,
mm-hmm.
because then you can get a layer of air in between, and then it takes forever to heat.
Yes. Mm.
All right, let's go to line number two and Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm kind of scared of this question, but it's been bothering me for years. I have a carpet, and the carpet is on the top of another carpet. So I walk into the room, and over a period of time, the carpet on the top crawls its way over. It gets out of alignment. It sort of walks on the other carpet, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So my question is, not that it does that, which seems pretty obvious why that would happen, but why, when I walk back the other direction, the carpet never goes in the other direction.
It All
never
right.
straightens itself out. It only wrinkles up in one direction, even if I walk both ways.
All right, great question, panel.
Wow.
I have a good facetious answer.
While
the others think about a real answer, my facetious answer has to do with the direction of the twist on the yarn of the carpet below. But that might not be totally facetious.
No, I think actually that's probably what it is. It's either the direction of the weave or the twisting, exactly as you're saying, so that it would work like the cilia that are beating mucus up, actually, from your respiratory system. They only really work in one direction, and then they only reload half the way back. So it's like a little ratchet. And
wow.
It's your rug's being ratcheted in one direction.
Wow.
You see, Harriet?
Yes.
That's how we roll here.
I do see, and I think that's really very interesting.
Interesting and a really good guess.
Well, that's, yes, it could be just a guess. But now, what if I took the carpet?
And did it the other way. Yes,
around.
That's what I would do if I were you. And then you'd call back and stump the chump, as we say in the business.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
Yep. I'll try. I'll get somebody to help me move this thing.
And you'll call us back?
That's yeah, always... but not today.
All right. Well, thank you, Harriet. I appreciate the call.
That's Let's always take... the problem with doing an experiment. You know, it just takes your great theory.
She needs interns, obviously.
Right down the...
Let's take a break here, Mr. Zach, and we'll be back at 1-800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop.
Support comes from Kingsway Community Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and services to area seniors since 1975, including assisted living and more. Caring in the family tradition. 518-393-8800. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, Rhinebeck and New Paltz, providing professional picture framing, fine art materials for students, professionals, and the public. The Atwater Art Gallery upstairs in Rhinebeck, rhinebeckart.com. Lori Stillwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StillwellCPA.com. And The Linda, presenting Garland Jeffries, Friday, January 24th at 8 p.m. TheLinda.org for more information.
Vox Pop on WAMC, The Science Forum, 1-800-348-2551. Ray Graff here, joined by Michael Murphy, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, and your questions at 800-348-2551. Bill in Rensselaerville, you're up.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a question that I believe I already know the answer to, but
oh,
I suppose you could verify it. Why does the atmosphere of our planet, and I guess for any other planet for that matter, is it gravity is the only force, the only reason that the atmosphere is not sucked off into the vacuum of space? It seems to me that that vacuum is just so overpowering, but I guess it's not. Is that the case? Is the only reason that the atmosphere stays in place?
Well, basically, it is gravity. The escape velocity of the Earth is about 23,000 miles per hour, and if the molecules of air are moving faster than that, they get off the Earth. And as you get further away from the center of gravity, as you get farther off into space, of course, they're able to escape, which is why when you get about 50 miles up, there's no more air.
Right.
Okay.
So that was easy.
Okay, yeah, I figured I knew the answer already. It just seemed, though, that, you know, considering the enormous vastness and vacuum of space, that it would just simply overpower anything.
Yeah.
But I guess that's not the case.
Well, that, actually, it's kind of a misconception that the vacuum pulls. You need something to push, actually, to move something into a vacuum. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So without air pressure, you know, the vacuum cleaner works because the air pressure pushes the air up through the tube and into where the fan is. So it's not like there's this great suction out in space that's trying to pull things away. What would happen is that if there was just a cloud of gas rather than the Earth holding in the atmosphere, if you just make the Earth disappear for a second, what will happen is that the gas molecules will just diffuse around in random motion and just kind of float away, away from each other.
Yeah, and one interesting thing is if you ever see a meteorite or a meteor come into the atmosphere, that usually starts at about 50 miles up and goes to about 40 miles up. So that's the top of the atmosphere where you start getting heating as a result of that.
Yeah. Right. Ionosphere, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks.
Okay, well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Have a nice day.
Okay, then if we take Bill's point, what happened to the atmosphere at Mars? From what I understand, the atmosphere at Mars was at one time much more dense. Why did they lose atmosphere on Mars? Why did the Martians lose their atmosphere?
Well, Mars is one-third the size of the Earth.
Yes.
So it has a much lower gravity.
Right, but it allegedly had much more of an atmosphere at one time.
Probably, well, first of all, it's a CO2 atmosphere, so carbon dioxide. So what it had is a much thicker carbon dioxide atmosphere because it had volcanoes. The volcanoes were continuously producing material that was going into the atmosphere. Because CO2 is a greenhouse gas, it was hot enough to allow water to run.
So it was losing it at the same rate?
It was losing it at a much faster rate than we were. The volcanoes probably stopped working at about 1.5 billion years ago.
I see.
So it's been going away ever since.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just not enough gravity to hold it in.
Makes sense. Speaking of gravity, let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. Joseph, you're on the Science Forum. Hi.
Hi. I wonder why we don't have artificial gravity for our space travelers.
Because you have to spin pretty fast to get a gravity effect. Effectively, what you do is replace gravity with a centripetal force. That's the basic idea of spacecraft. But you have to go pretty fast in order to be doing that. And the best way to do it would be to have something that's pretty large. And we don't have anything large enough to do that right now.
Would that ever be possible in the future, like the science fiction programs show?
Yeah, there's one model, for example, where they're talking about taking a giant tube balloon and putting spokes in the center of it, having it move out into space. And because it's so big with this giant balloon that they'd fill with water, for example, spinning around, you'd actually have artificial gravity within the balloon.
How far away is that feasibly for astronauts?
NASA's already funding it, so who knows?
Interesting.
Okay.
All right,
thank you.
Joseph, thanks a lot. That's an interesting question. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Jeffrey in Lenox, you're next on the Science Forum.
Good afternoon. I've got a chemistry question for you.
All right.
As you probably know, phosphorus in our waterways has been a problem because of the algae growth it promotes. And here in Massachusetts, they've taken heroic measures to lower the phosphates and laundry detergents and everything. But one of the growing problems in the waterways is people are flushing away disposable wipes like baby wipes. And a little bit of research on the internet has shown that the 45 most popular brands of baby wipes have as their main ingredient potassium lauryl phosphate. And I'm wondering, and this is a growing problem, I'm wondering if that form of phosphate would contribute to the algae growth
if there's enough, it certainly would. The phosphate should have no problem dissociating in water, so... I would guess it would take a fair number of baby wipes for that to happen because you get quite a dilution effect. But yes,
well,
it's possible.
In Great Barrington, they're pulling away 3 tons a week. They're pulling it out of their system.
3 tons in Great Barrington alone?
Yeah.
3 tons in Great Barrington alone.
It's a lot of babies.
And they're devoting 1,020 man hours a year just getting this out of the system. Apparently, there's some kind of electrostatic property where they attract themselves to each other, and they just clog up the waterways. But I was wondering, because basically these are like tea bags that leach all of their chemicals into the water. And I was wondering if that, as you, well, I guess you've mentioned that that phosphate can disassociate.
Yeah.
And, yeah. But and the, create that problem.
The amount, the percentage of the wipe that's actually that phosphate is extremely small. Right. When you consider like the amount of phosphate that would be in a cup of the old-fashioned laundry detergent,
yeah.
That would be a lot, equivalent to a lot of baby wipes.
That's an interesting question.
It's just a tiny amount, but yes, I agree. It will hydrolyze to make phosphate.
Having said that, algal blooms are really quite sensitive to even low amounts of added phosphate. So,
I'd be interested to know what the sodium lauryl phosphate actually does for the baby wipes. I mean, the sodium lauryl sulfate, for example, is in every shampoo to make
the
suds.
Detergent, right.
It's a detergent.
And I wonder if that does the same thing. Yeah. It just makes their bottoms look cleaner.
Yeah. Ah, well, thanks for that. Scott in Slingerland. Scott, you're on.
Hi. I was getting back to the question about freezing of water. It's a question I've pondered for a long time. I was told that it doesn't freeze as quickly because the temperature change of water isn't a third-order function from mathematics.
All right. I have no idea what
accurate?
You just said, so let's ask the scientists.
I have no idea either. I'm sorry.
In other words, there's some things that that describe momentum, and that freezing of water simply doesn't have momentum, so the explanation about hot water freezing faster than cold water in a freezer.
Well, you know, if you take hot water and cold water and put it outside on a day like today, the cold water will freeze faster.
Yes.
You need a closed environment, which suggests that it's really a case of nucleation more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty easy thing to test. In fact, if you take the hot water and put a cover over it, and the cold water and put a cover over it, the hot water will freeze even faster, simply because the cover acts as a place for the little crystals to form and then fall down into the water.
Okay.
So it's a pretty easy experiment to try, and it's rather interesting to do it. If all things are equal, the cold water will freeze faster simply because it has less energy to lose before it gets to the point of freezing.
And my question really gets at the idea that some people think that some things in life have momentum that really don't have momentum, and I think that... that's part of the perception that the hot water would freeze faster because, in a sense, the temperature differential is greater and would pick up momentum when, in fact, it's not a third-order function. It doesn't have
momentum. No, it isn't.
Momentum.
Okay.
No.
Great.
Good.
Anybody else on the panel want to take a whack?
I'll do it.
All right, Scott, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Lynn in Shelburne Falls, Mass. You're on. Lynn.
Yes, yeah, sorry. I hope you'll forgive me for being a total arse. But
okay.
Yes. So if I just barely got a hold of the last person's calling, but so if my pipes, will the hot water freeze colder than fast water, faster than the
okay.
water?
Okay. Pipe freezing question. Good. Very appropriate for this time of year. Go.
I can tell you something about pipes freezing. How about that?
Please do.
It's very important. When a pipe freezes, it's usually not the ice that's forming that causes a pipe to break. The pipe actually breaks because what you do is you have water on the outside and water on the inside, and you've shut off the valve on the inside.
But what if it doesn't break?
Well, if it doesn't break, first of all, it does break sometimes because when the ice grows, it pushes the water, which is incompressible, till it gets into as small a space as it can be, and then it pops out to break the pipe.
Mm.
That's the reason it usually happens. Hot water in a pipe probably will freeze slower than cold water in a pipe because there's no place for nucleation sites to form if the pipe is full.
That's what I was wondering about, yeah. Well, very good, thank you. So that settles that for me.
Right. If you have pipes, by the way, just for everyone, that freeze during the winter,
yes.
Especially pipes that go from the inside to the outside, what you do is make sure that pipe from the outside to the inside is empty. Because if there's any water inside there, then the water will form ice, the ice will start compressing the liquid, and then the liquid will break. That's
so you're thinking that, because a week ago or so, it froze from the well, I believe, to the house.
Right.
And it took it about a week and a half for it to get that nice warm weather in. And so you're telling me that maybe if I'm on really cold nights, I shut off the pump and empty the pipes?
Well, if you do that, certainly you won't have a problem. But the better way to do it is just to let the water run a little bit.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
And that makes it a lot easier.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Lynn, thank you very much. And a perfect question for today. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Bill in New Paltz. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to offer an idea about why the two carpets might be slipping.
Oh, terrific.
The weave may well have a lot to do with it. But I don't know if you determined if she was walking with the same force in each direction. I think it would be hard to tell, even if we're in a foyer and she were walking back and forth between in a foyer, because she might be coming out of one room faster than another. Or she might be slowing to go into a room. She might be, I have a carpet that creeps a little, and we walk mainly on one side of that carpet because some of it is under a table. So just offering that... high school physics, vector of force. I lost 15 points on a test for that.
Well, I give it to you. You got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, we'll award you 15 points now, and you should be even.
No, it doesn't account for the other points.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. It's Tim in Marion, Massachusetts. You're on.
Yeah, hi. My name is Tim.
Hello,
and,
Tim.
And hi, a number of years ago, I'm a sailboater, and so a number of years ago, I had gone into, I'd gotten out of the channel, and I run my sailboat aground. And so the way to get yourself off is to wait for the high tide to come, and the boat will float itself off, and you'll be on your way. So I pulled out my trusty tide tables, double-checked what time the high tide was going to be there, and sort of sat and waited. And, you know, I sort of got close to what I thought and had read in the tide tables when the high tide was, but sort of began to notice that the boat was actually sort of leaning more, which meant the tide was going down. And then I waited a little bit longer, and in fact, the tide did come up. And so I boat eventually floated off, but I sort of wondered about this, and eventually did a little bit of research and discovered that actually right before the high tide each day, the tide does actually recede a little bit before it goes all the way up. And so I was sort of wondering why that occurred.
Well, if you can imagine, when there's a high tide, the water, let's take the easiest situation. The moon is directly overhead, and the water is being pulled towards the moon, and that's the high tide. Okay? Well, the water that's under the moon has got to get there somehow. And so there's a certain amount of water that will rush on both sides of the high tide towards the position of the high tide. So that might be part of it. Another part of it might be that it's a seiche wave, which is the water that sloshes around, for example, in a bucket. If you take a bucket and start slushing it back and forth, you'll get a wave developing.
Yeah.
And the water always goes down before it starts to go up again.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
If you're in an enclosed area, then that would be also a possible reason for it.
Huh.
And I have seen that happen before the tides.
Yeah, I actually did. In the New England waters is the trusty Eldritch tide table that everyone uses, and I did actually research it in parts of that tide book, and it says yes, that there is a tide does recede a slight amount before it reaches its full.
Right.
And there, it does that every day.
There's another thing to think about this as well, is that when the Earth is spinning, the moon over the top of the Earth, which is pulling the tide towards it, is very much like a boat going through the water. It forms a bow wave.
Yeah.
Okay? And the further away, the further down the moon is from the zenith, from the top, the longer it takes for the tide to get there.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, in any bow wave, in any boat, in any bow wave, there's always a forward bow wave before the main bow.
That's right.
So the water goes down, and then it goes up at the bow wave.
Yeah, right.
So
right,
that wave then carries itself through as the Earth rotates. So there's always going to be a lower bow wave before the upper one just because of that.
Yeah, right. That's actually an interesting analogy.
Anybody else on the panel want to weigh in here?
No, these are all nice physics questions, so I'm keeping my distance as a biologist.
All right, Michael, thank you very much. Hey, Tim, thank you very much for the great call. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Why now? Let's go to Joe in Middle Grove. Joe, you're on.
Oh, hi, guys. excuse me. I've got a static electricity question that is, like, in three parts.
All right.
So I've been – there's a lot of static at work lately, so I've been getting zapped whenever I go to touch anything metal. So I've been using a key to discharge it so I don't get zapped. Hmm. And I've been paying attention to the arc, and some of them are almost a centimeter long, which brings me to ask, one, how many volts would that be to arc that far? Two, what's the temperature of it? And three, is that snap I hear just a little tiny sonic boom?
Well, I can give you part of it. The voltage is about 10,000 volts.
But not a lot of amps.
Not a lot of amps,
no.
Fortunately.
No, yeah. Right.
As far as the heat goes, I don't really know. I'm sure there has to be something there. And the snap is actually the air being ionized and then snapping back into that area.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah, it so is. It's not actually rushing out like from, say, lightning bolt?
Yeah, very similar to a lightning bolt.
Yep. And the temperature is probably, in order to get incandescence like that, it's got to be a couple thousand degrees, I would think.
Sheesh.
But just in a very small spot.
Fortunately.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh. A short duration.
Okay. Yes.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Great spot to take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum.
Support comes from St. Joseph School, Uptown Kingston, an academy of arts and sciences offering pre-K, elementary, and middle school placements for fall 2014. Daily tours of our historic Uptown campus, joyful learning guided by faith. StJosephSchoolKingston.com. Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havoc and Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts. Providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavocandWealthStrategies.com. Oblong Books and Hudson Valley YA Society. Presenting Lucy Christopher, Len Vlahos, and Margot Froley, Sunday, February 2nd, 4 p.m. in Rhinebeck. RSVP required, oblongbooks.com. And Spectrum 8 Theaters, Albany, New York, showing Hollywood, American independent, and foreign films, and presenting London's National Theatre Series in HD and digital sound. Open daily, spectrum8.com.
one 800 348 2551 is the telephone number. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. I'm Ray Graff. We're joined by Michael Murphy, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. They're our scientists, and you are calling with your scientific questions. And, you know, I just wish we could have a question about laundry, because, you know, it's not a show without a laundry question. Could somebody help me? Oh, Donna and Saugerties, you're on. Donna? Oh, no, Donna's not there. Is this Evan?
Yeah, it's Evan.
Okay, well, you better have a question about laundry.
No, but I have to do laundry, so...
All right, well, can we talk about that for a few minutes?
Well, that's not a scientific dilemma. I just get off the couch and do it.
All right, so what do you got?
Anyway, I was very disappointed. This whole thing about the Jovian plutonium gravitational effect. On January 4th at 9:46, we were supposed to jump up in the air... And instead of taking 0.2 seconds to come down like every other day, we were supposed to take 3 seconds to come down because of the perfect alignment of Jupiter, Pluto, and the Earth. This was prophesied by this guy Moore, an astronomer. What happened? Why didn't it work? Everything lined up. I was very disappointed. I jumped, and I was down before I knew it.
Oh, that's... All right, who wants this?
Familiar with it?
I feel so bad for you. You know, when I just to let you know, when I get that kind of want that kind of rush, I go over to the South Mall and jump up and down in the elevators.
Yeah.
And they give me such a look when I get up to the top because it's the fastest elevator in New York, and you can stay up in the air for over 2 extra seconds.
Really?
It's well worth it.
You've actually done this?
Many, many, many times.
What elevator is this?
This is the elevator in the South Mall Tower.
Oh, gosh.
And you can do the same thing as you get down to the bottom. you do a deep knee bend, and then when the door opens, you're still down there, and everyone stares at you. It's really fun.
We really have to vet your appearances with our legal department because, you know, there are some possibilities here. All right. So,
but, yeah, there's a thing called the Grand Conjunction. It happens all the time. There's actually a town in Mississippi. I think it's in Mississippi, that every time there's a Grand Conjunction, everybody leaves because they're sure there's going to be an earthquake for the same reason. The trouble is Jupiter's just a little bit too far away. The moon, on the other hand, every time the moon goes directly overhead, the Earth actually rises up a little bit to meet it by a couple centimeters. So if you were to try to do that when the moon's directly overhead, it probably worked better.
Well, you need a little less water when you do your laundry, but that could pertain to your laundry.
There's this law of inverse squares that just plays havoc with these sort of things. The further away you are, the less...
Why did I believe it? I got so excited. I feel so stupid now. Don't tell anyone I'm talking to you about this. Okay?
Well, the good news is you did the experiment.
Yeah. Good for you. And I'm sorry, from now on, we only want questions about laundry. But
and just to mention that Mars is going to be the largest it's going to be in 2,000 years sometime next week.
Okay. Terrific.
Wow, that's really
size of a full moon.
The size of a full moon is going to be incredible.
He saw it on the internet. Evan, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. All right. John in Clifton Park calling from New York City. Nice to have you here. John, you're on.
How are you?
Good.
Actually, just passing through here. I just wanted to ask you a quick question about the gold mining or lack of gold mining in the Adirondacks.
Okay. Right.
All right.
That's a geology question. Cool.
A couple of friends of mine and I went out a couple of times, and, you know, we see these gold shows on TV, so we think, okay, yeah, let's go find some gold. And we found little flakes here, just, you know, here and there in the streams. But why is it there in the first place? And if there is a significant amount, how come there is no mining? And there are many laws about it. If you find it, you can't keep it. New York State has a, even if you find it in your own backyard.
Well, that's New York for you.
Yeah.
All right. What do you think?
Well, let me tell you where gold comes from, first of all. When you have a large magmatic body underground, there's always going to be a certain amount of gold and silver and things of that nature inside of it, okay? And the as the magmatic body cools, the last thing to cool are the noble elements like gold and silver and things like that. So they wind up getting congregated in the last melt. Another thing that gets congregated in the last melt is quartz. So very often what you'll have are quartz veins shooting up in an area, and there'll be gold and silver associated with it.
So if you find quartz, you may be in the ballpark of some gold.
That's very often what you'll look for. For example, out west, if you see a gold quartz veins in a rock, a large quartz veins, you start looking for the gold associated with that.
Okay.
In this area, the magma that formed the Adirondacks was very, very unusual in that it had very, very little quartz, things like that. In fact, the Adirondacks themselves are almost entirely made of feldspar. There's nothing in there. So it's around the outside of the Adirondacks. There's a bit. But the magma that formed it was very unusual. It only occurs in a couple places of the world, and we have no idea why. But it's not very high in gold whatsoever. And certainly that last little bit that would have formed it doesn't seem to have ever happened.
Michael?
Yeah, there's a really interesting science article that came out in the last 2 weeks about miners now. They're using plants to detect where high concentrations of gold are, because plants actually can take up gold and put it into their vascular system where it becomes entrapped. And so instead of having to do very, very expensive test drills, they're simply sampling the plants and bringing them back to the laboratory. And actually it's working in about 60-70% of the time in areas where they suspect a gold may be present. The images, by the way, from that study are quite beautiful. You see these very, very fine flecks of gold in the vascular system of these plants.
I guess money grows on trees then, huh?
Just
but, you know, it's funny because I read an article about that, and that was the slogan that got my attention. And it was the eucalyptus plants in, I think it was either Southeast Asia or it was some other kind of plants in Australia. And I was reading about that, and it was interesting. So, I mean, you're not going to go chopping down trees and getting gold out of it, but it's microscopic to see how far down these roots go, to see how far down you'd have to mine for it. And it was pretty interesting.
That's
but
right.
I was always told it was glacier gold that was up on the Adirondacks, and you find a lot of it in the streams.
Hmm. There could be, and but if there is, it's pretty small, and it's really hard to find.
That's why there's no mining up there.
That's right. All right, it's really called placers.
Thank you. We got to move it along, but thank you very much. And this one comes from our control room laundry question. Why do smaller items get entwined and stuck in bigger, like sheets? Is there a name or a word for that? Panel? Why do smaller items get entwined?
Again, I'm looking at the physicist, so.
Well, bigger things have a lot harder time moving around. So the smaller things wind up getting entwined simply because they can move and they get stuck inside the larger ones that can't move, especially when you have torsion action going on.
Ah, torsion action.
And you're much more likely to get a sock inside a big sheet than you are to wrap a sheet inside
of a sock.
Yes. So there's some thermodynamics in there.
Zen-like show we have here. Right. Here's one via email. From Kevin, I'm curious as to whether or not it is possible to set up wind farms along hurricane paths. Any chance those winds could be harvested for electricity panel?
No. when the wind blows too hard, they turn the wind turbines off.
Okay.
28 miles an hour. It's pretty as fast as they can go. The other problem is that when you have a wind tower, you want to make sure the wind's always blowing pretty well in the same direction. And in the case of a hurricane, they change direction quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah. And my question is, if we had enough wind farms, if there were millions and millions and millions of them, could we deplete the wind? Could we block all the wind and then have a wind shortage?
Yeah, because you're taking that energy and converting it to electricity. So, I mean, in principle, if you put all the wind turbines chock-a-block, you'll stop the wind.
Yeah, not only that, but you'll have a windfall.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask a question. Is that really pragmatically possible, considering how high the winds go, and then these are relatively low to the earth? Yeah. I mean, you're missing a lot of wind.
Yeah. That's right.
You need an infinite number of windmills made by an infinite number of monkeys.
By the premise, Michael, and by the gag. That's what Carson used to say. Dee in Glenmont. Dee, you're on.
Hi, guys. Question. I'm going to go back to the freezing pipes question.
Excellent.
Okay. I live in a manufactured home and recently got a letter from my landlord saying that the water running prevents pipes from freezing effects the water pressure in the supply in the community and also freezes the water in the sewer line under the home. Is that accurate?
I didn't quite understand the last part of that.
Try that again.
What they're saying is running water to prevent pipes from freezing.
Correct.
Affects the water pressure and the supply in our particular community, and it also freezes the water in the sewer line under the home. And they're telling us it's prohibited.
Well,
not to let your water drip.
In the town of Bethlehem?
Yeah.
Well, first, I didn't get
that memo.
Yeah, I didn't either. First of all, the amount of water that should be dripping out of a pipe is not very large. It doesn't have to drip very fast or very hard to keep the thing from freezing. What you're doing effectively is keeping a little hole in the ice that's forming to keep the pressure down so that you don't get a pipe burst. The amount of water, therefore, going into the sewer lines, first of all, the sewer lines are warm, not only from the biological activity, and there you go, Michael, the biological activity in the sewer lines, but also because they're underground. And so they're not being affected so much by freezing weather. So the chances of the water actually freezing in the sewer lines is extremely small.
It also doesn't make sense because most people run their water, dripping it, in the evening. And more water use happens actually in the early morning when people are showering and bathing. And so I would really question it. I would wonder where the person got his or her data.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I think because we've had a couple pipe bursts in our particular community. Now, I remind you, I live in a manufactured home, so it's those old mobile homes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It shouldn't make a difference. Actually, I mean, flushing a toilet puts down a lot more water than a dripping toilet, for example, or a dripping line.
Yeah. But I could see, though, like in a case like this where a sewer line or, say, the outflow from the home goes through an air gap before going underground, and you're just trickling water through. In principle, you could build up ice on that if that pipe wasn't insulated.
But that would be in the house or near the house.
Yeah, that would be near the house.
It wouldn't be the sewer line.
It wouldn't be the sewer line underground.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Dee, good luck, and maybe it'll warm up at some point. Let's go to Larry in Hyde Park. Hiya, Larry, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick question, and I will hang up. How did water first occur in the universe, and how abundant is it? And I'll listen for your answer.
Thanks, Larry. We appreciate it.
Well, it first appeared in the universe. Well, let's take a solar system first. It first appeared in the solar system right at the beginning. Some of our planets are all made out of ice, or effectively all made out of ice. As far as the universe is concerned, the most abundant elements in the universe are hydrogen and oxygen. So water probably occurred extremely early, probably right after the Big Bang.
Well, hydrogen and helium.
Hydrogen and helium, sure.
Oxygen would have been formed in the first suns that were, in the first stars that were made. And then when those went nova, it would have put oxygen out.
I agree.
And then the oxygen rapidly would have combined with hydrogen.
So within the first couple million years.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to run through kind of one solar cycle to get oxygen.
A solar cycle being the life and death of a star.
Of a star, yeah.
Yep.
Michael, anything?
Nope, I'm good on that.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Bill in Gloversville. Bill.
Yes. I took a physics course in 1977 at Cornell University.
Okay.
And they taught us that a photon has no mass whatsoever. And yet I said to myself, if this were true, how could it be that a black star and its gravitational force can suck light into it and not let it escape?
Okay. A photon, in fact, you can nitpick your way around saying that a photon has mass, but from my point of view, a photon does not have mass. The black hole traps the light because the extreme gravitational pull warps the space around it, so that the space basically curves back on itself and the photon can't get out.
So theoretically, photons are still in there, but they can't get out.
Yeah, that's right. And like the gravitational lens, now I'm into your ballywick with the astronomy, but light that goes past a massive object will be bent by that object because the space around it is bent, and the photon or the light wave goes with the flow.
Oh, okay. I think I understand now. Thank you very
Excellent.
Much.
Bill, we appreciate the call. Jim and Cahos. Jim.
Yes, I was just wondering, does heating elements on Earth, such as cars and stoves and so forth, create more heat for global warming than the ozone layer, the problem with the ozone layer?
Well, the ozone layer doesn't stop. I don't believe the ozone layer stops any heat. It's not carbon dioxide. It's ozone. It's O3, so it doesn't have much effect on the heat of the Earth at all.
I thought they said if we get holes in the ozone layer where it's opening up, the heat's escaping.
No, what it does is the ozone layer blocks a lot of ultraviolet and such that comes into the atmosphere, and if you get rid of the ozone layer, then you wind up increasing your
radiation.
Yeah. And that winds up giving you melanoma and things like that.
Yeah, the ozone does absorb.
Yeah.
Radiation. So the ozone contributes to heating the stratosphere, but it really doesn't affect the heat down here very much.
Right.
All right. Jim, good?
Other question is that lady with the rug.
Yeah.
If her floor is not level, that'll cause the rug to crawl too.
Okay. There could be the level situation. All right. That makes a good point, and that's where we'll have to leave it, Jim.
I have one more question.
We only have about 10 seconds, so make it snappy.
Oh. Why do more girls call in, or why do more men call in, or fellas call in than girls?
Is this a trick question?
It actually probably depends on the day also, I think.
It does, and it also depends on just the way things go on this show. It's a fairly even number. And, today,
and it has to do with the unemployment rate as well.
No, it does not. All right, here's one final one, and I'll give you guys about 30 seconds here. This came in via email from Carl. Can you point us towards some reliable sources where a civilian can get a good sense of what the science actually is on climate change / global warming? That's from Carl.
There is a site on the internet. It's called Climate and Art, believe it or not. And they have about 150 graphs that show the effects of climate change throughout the ages and various sites as well associated with that. That's one of my favorite places.
And in fact, last time I read the Wikipedia article on climate change, it seemed pretty accurate.
Okay. And Wikipedia, I mean, sometimes it's right on, but I guess there are times when it might not be. But that one would seem to be all right to you.
The last I looked, which was some time ago. But
yeah, some of them are full of hot air, but not that one.
Oh, jeez. All right. Well, listen, we are. That's very good. You always have to get that last laugh in. Thanks to Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Michael Murphy for being here. Thanks to you for listening. Support comes from Buttermilk Falls Inn, Milton, a 75-acre Hudson Riverfront resort with lodging, a farm-to-table restaurant, and spa. Buttermilkfallsinn.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors, currancompliance.com. Mohonk Preserve, New Paltz, presenting the Rock the Ridge 50-Mile Challenge for runners, walkers, hikers on May 3rd. Sponsored by I Love New York and Ulster County Alive. RockTheRidge50.org for registration. And Lexington Vacuum, Albany, New York, featuring Miele, Simplicity, Dyson, Electrolux, Vapori Vapor Cleaning, Sales Service Repairs, LEXIVAC.com. That's it for the show. Boy, that was a lot of fun. Thanks to our scientists. Thanks to you for calling. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy, our producer, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, at this time, it's Food Friday. Stay tuned now for a news update.